You're listening to The Point. NASA's astrobiology program investigates life in the universe on many levels, how it began, how it evolved here on Earth, and where it might exist elsewhere. Even as we search for the existence of life on other planets, we continue to learn about the life on our own planet. For example, it was just 50 years ago that researchers from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution discovered life at the deepest parts of the ocean. This discovery revolutionized our understanding of how and where life could exist on Earth and even on other planets. Given that discovery and the five decades of research since, it's not surprising that NASA is turning to oceanographers and biologists to better understand conditions under which we might find life in other parts of the universe. NASA's astrobiology program solicited grant proposals from throughout the country, and of the four flagship research projects selected, two are being led by researchers here on Cape Cod, Chris German's lab at HUI and Emil Ruff's lab at MBL. Joining us, Chris German, senior scientist in geology and geophysics at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Emil Ruff, microbial ecologist at the Ecosystem Center at Marine Biological Laboratory. Welcome, Emil.
Hi, nice to be there.
So we have two of NASA's top four new projects to search for life beyond Earth nationwide being run from research laboratories focused on the oceans in one tiny corner of Cape Cod. How come? Why us?
I guess we're just that good. I mean, less facetiously, I mean, you know, we are a tiny, you know, it is a real hub, right, for ocean research.
Yeah,
like if you wander along Water Street, it's even not just our two laboratories, right? There's the NOAA Fisheries Lab. There's a lot going on.
Yeah. We're like the science mecca.
Yeah.
And
that was it. I mean, I remember the first time I came here, I'd been in Cambridge University and then I was at MIT and I was studying at MIT. And then it was like, wait, there's a place right down there. Isn't that just where the ferry goes? Isn't that where the road runs out? And but that's also where the ocean begins, I guess.
So. Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's start with how the discovery of life at the deep sea vents changed our understanding of where life might be.
Okay, if I take that one first, then I think the real thing here was what was wrapped up inside that was that hydrothermal vents can be thought of as a geothermal system, but the real issue of where the microbes at the base of the food chain are making a living is from chemical energy. So it's any way you can get chemical energy. And so hydrothermal systems are one way you can do that. If you've got some kind of geothermal, like imagine like a volcanic system, then if there's magma and heat inside the planet that's still trying to come out, then that heat can then mix up. And if any water can percolate down into the rocks, then that's one of the ways you can start making the rocks and the water react together. So hydrothermal systems tend to be kind of acidic, and so they're corrosive, and so you can dissolve up some interesting chemicals, and then when you bring them back up to mix with the other seawater, you get chemical reactions taking place, and microbes can actually catalyze those reactions and use them to release energy and fix carbon and make life for themselves.
Emil, you have thoughts to add to that?
Well, yes, and that is just happening at the sea floor, and now we know that life extends well past the sea floor, deep into the sediment, into the ocean itself or the sea floor itself, where these chemical reactions are extremely important, because no light and not even any organic matter from the surface ocean can ever penetrate to these deep layers in the sea floor.
All right, so give us your elevator pitch, just 2 minutes to explain the research that you're going to be doing as part of the NASA grant. Emil, why don't you go first?
So we are looking at exactly these organisms that live deep in, trapped in, inside marine sediments and in rocks deep beneath our feet. In the past decades, we have realized that a majority probably of microbial cells on Earth live in these obscure, dark, and deep ecosystems. And we have now realized that, and that is one of the reasons why NASA is interested in this research, is that if you go 2 or 3 kilometers deep below Earth into the rock, the organisms that are trapped there in the brines and in the fracture fluids in the rock, they have been there for millions of years. They have been sitting there isolated from the surface for millions of years. And so if you think of what kind of life could ever have existed on Mars or might still exist there, it will very likely be life trapped deep inside the Martian rocks, because the surface of Mars is too hostile. It's too hot, too cold, too much radiation. So if any life has ever survived or is present on Mars, it will be trapped deep inside the Martian rock. And Martian rock is very similar to Earth rock. And so what we're doing in this project is we try to understand microbes that live deep inside these rocks on Earth. For example, we just went to South Africa to an expedition into a South African gold mine, almost 3 kilometers deep, to sample such ecosystems.
Chris?
Okay, so where Emil is thinking about Mars, my project is thinking even further out in the solar system, in the moons around Jupiter and Saturn, where we know those moons have an icy and a frozen water outer shell, and then saltwater oceans underneath with rocky seafloors. So again, like Emil, we're thinking about life that could be originating, or the conditions for life that could be originating deep down at the bottom of the ocean, in the sediments or at the seafloor. And then we're wondering about how are you going to detect that from a NASA spacecraft that's going to arrive at the outside of the shell. And so we're thinking about if the signals are down at the bottom of the ocean. In particular, a lot of the programs that are being developed are thinking about the way to look for life is to look for the right kind of carbon compounds that we're all made up of. So telltale signs like, can we find amino acids or proteins? And so the thing is, on Earth, we have lots and lots of carbon in the form of life. On other planets, it turns out meteorites have an awful lot of the same kind of complicated, or not the same sort, but they have a lot of complicated carbon compounds in them anyway, just as just rock. If you just soak it in water, then you will end up with water that has some carbon compounds in it. And so a real question would be, if you had water coming out of the surface of an ocean world like Europa or Enceladus, and you could measure carbon compounds, how would you know whether they're life or not? So that's really what we're looking at, is what's the fate of those carbon
Yeah,
compounds?
sounds fascinating. So we'll talk more about the research in it, but I want to talk about each of you, your path into science and some of the mile markers or forks in the road that got you to this point in your career and research. Emil, what tell us about your path into science.
Yeah, so I grew up in Germany and did my undergrad work in nanobiotechnology. Very, very different from what I ended up doing. And I was fascinated by all kinds of biology, and I saw this opportunity to work on deep sea, cold sea ecosystems, so systems at the seafloor, similar to what Chris is studying, where there's oases of life that are fueled just by chemical compounds. And so I completely changed fields, did my PhD in marine microbiology. And then I realized that I like to know what's below my feet. I don't just like the ocean, but I also realized that we don't know enough about groundwater. Groundwater is an extremely vulnerable resource that we all rely on worldwide, and very little is known. So I went to Canada to for my first independent research project on a fellowship to understand the microbiomes of groundwater. And from there, I sort of I took a job at the Marine Biological Laboratory, still working on groundwater, but also going back to marine science. But in the end, now my work really spans ecosystems from 3 kilometers deep inside the rock to marine surface and coastal ecosystems. So, as an ecologist, we have similar questions to different ecosystems. So therefore, I can work on different ecosystems asking similar questions. How do microbes interact with each other? How do microbes interact with the environment? And how does that translate to, for example, ecosystem health and climate change?
All right, Chris, what was your path?
It was weird. In middle school, by middle school age, I already knew I didn't want anything to do with the sea. I had a family who worked at the local naval dockyard, and that was not going to be where I wanted to go. And then by the time I was like the equivalent of entering high school here in the US, I knew I didn't want anything to do with geology either, because my older brother and my mom had got really into that stuff. And geology, where I grew up, just southeast of London, was basically walking through mud flats at low tide in the Thames estuary, just looking at sediments and seeing if there were like little bits of fossilized something. And that was not what I wanted to do either. So I went to college determined to be a chemical engineer and work up, you know, end up working for like a big oil company in a refinery. That was kind of like what I thought I was going to do with my math and chemistry interests. And then I took freshman geology anyway. When I got to college, you had to take up at least one subject you hadn't done before. And I worked out that geology was all about volcanoes and earthquakes and plate tectonics, and it was a lot more interesting than I realized. So I kind of got dragged into that, or drawn into that, as I was going through college, that I got more into combining geology and chemistry. And then right before my final year, we had to go out and do an honors project in the field. And mine, I got taken with my head of department and a professor of volcanoes, and we went to the Italian Alps. The geology was fantastic. The scenery was fantastic, but I found I had no head for heights. there was one volcano I remember I disgraced myself. I got a nosebleed as we were like on our way back down, just from the stress of like coping with what I'd been going through. So then I found out there was a field called oceanography, and that's kind of what I've been in ever since, because now I can still study volcanoes, but if they're underwater, then I can't fall off them. I can carry out all my underwater, I can carry out volcanic research and stay at sea level.
That's so funny. You know, you were talking about Jupiter's icy moon and Saturn's mm-hmm. counterpart maybe being favorable places to discover life beyond Earth. What do we currently know about these ocean worlds, and what makes them such a, you know, a great spot for the possibility of life?
I think the first thing we know about them is that the underneath the icy shell, there is definitely a layer of liquid, salty water. And if it's salty, it means, just like on Earth, it means rocks have been dissolved up into them. And we also know from the density, we know each of them has a solid rocky interior. And there isn't really anywhere that we can go on Earth. That's basically been my career for the last some decades, is trying to think, is there anywhere you can go to where you have rocks and water and you don't get some kind of chemical reaction? Mm. And we really can't. We've failed so far. We haven't been able to find somewhere where that doesn't happen.
So that's a good sign.
So the flip side of that is, well, then it probably does happen. So that's what we've been working on, is to think that there probably is that kind of chemistry happening at the seafloor. So the chemical energy should be there. At Europa, we kind of like, that's as far as we can go at the moment. But we have a new mission heading that way we can talk about.
So you'll be studying how physical, chemical, and possibly biological processes could shape any organic molecular signal, right? Mm-hmm. So for those of us who are not geochemists, can you explain what, you know, where and how you're going to be studying this on Earth?
Right. Mostly in our computers and in our laboratories. So a lot of this is hinged on some really smart younger scientists developing some very interesting algorithms that can basically do very efficient modeling and processing of, imagine there's a hydrothermal system that I know about on the seafloor, and it might have a certain pressure and it'll have a certain temperature and the water will be flowing through at a certain rate and the rocks are of a certain composition and the seawater is Earth seawater composition. So that's five different things that all combine just so to generate a kind of hydrothermal fluid I find. So then think about how many ways you could change any one of those five variables and all the different ways that those things could be varied, and then all the myriad ways that the composition of the fluid that comes out could be different. Mm. And so that's what we're trying to do. And so we have people now that one of those calculations, if I just changed one thing of like, oh, what happens if I turn the temperature up 10 degrees? It might take a day of computing power to then go back through. And now we have people who can actually do thousands of those in 15 minutes. So
what questions do you hope to answer, and how might those answers help us inform our exploration of other planets?
I think we're going to learn about whether there's the building blocks for life there, and also whether there's evidence that anything's actually taking advantage of that. I mean, it's like, imagine you find a Lego set, right? And it could just be a whole bunch of bricks that you tread on and you hurt your feet. Or it could be something that's been turned into some amazing structure because somebody's actually made use of the set. So that's the kind of thing of like, we could look and say, okay, can we see all the building blocks for Lego? Or can we see anything, any evidence that something's been put in the Legos together? Mm. So that's the first thing. And we're hoping that's what we're trying to explore in the next few years, is making sure that that's a reasonable expectation, that we might even be able to look at that and find that kind of thing on the outside. So one of the things we're trying to work at is, even if you had all the building blocks and you'd put them all together somewhere in the ocean, would they have all got knocked apart again by the time they could actually make it out to the surface? Are they going to go through other processes that mean you would never actually hope, you know? So, because if you fly past a planet and you're looking for these organic Legos, if you only find a scattering of Legos on the surface and no structure, the question would be, is that because life was never here, in which case we should move on? Or might that be a false negative that, in fact, there was life there, it's just it's broken back down again. Mm. And so that's where you've got the missing parts. Mm. And how would you tell the two apart? And so that's really what we're going after.
Fascinating. Emil, as you mentioned earlier, you're going to be looking at how dioxygen appears in environments where there isn't any light. So for you, you're looking like inside that rock, right? So tell us more about what you'll be doing in your research.
Yeah, so now that we're going into the details, Chris just talked about these molecules that are telltale for life, these so-called biomarker molecules that NASA is looking for. And one of those molecules is oxygen, so the oxygen molecule, O2. O2 is an extremely powerful or very energetic molecule that's quite difficult to make chemically. And on Earth, the major way to produce oxygen is connected to life. Life has discovered or invented photosynthesis. And so the harvesting of light to create energy in a cell. And what they do is they take the sunlight and split water, and oxygen is produced as a byproduct. This is essential for Earth as we know it. Life as we know it would exist on Earth without this amazing discovery or this invention by life about 2 billion years ago. And as you know, humans and all animals couldn't survive without oxygen too. We breathe oxygen to create energy. And so if you look out and you look at spectroscopically at the atmospheres of different planets, one of the first thing that's always looked at is, do these planets contain oxygen? Because a substantial amount of oxygen is a very good indicator that something really weird is going on. If you were an alien spacecraft and you would look at Earth from far away and you would see we have 20% oxygen in our atmosphere, a very unstable, very reactive molecule, this alien intelligence would probably conclude that something weird is going on Earth, maybe life. And so what my team is doing, we have this paradigm that all oxygen on Earth is produced by photosynthesis is kind of being challenged in recent years, because we did find, as a research community, we did find microbes that can produce oxygen without light, without the help of the sun, deep inside these rocks that we're looking at. They can produce oxygen from other precursor chemical molecules. And now that is really a completely new way that we hadn't had on our radar, how energy, how life can be sustained in Earth subsurface, but how life could also be sustained in other planets' subsurfaces or ecosystems. So what we're doing is similar to Chris. We're trying to understand, what does oxygen look like that is produced by these dark oxygen producers? And if we find oxygen on other celestial bodies, Can we tell where it's coming from, whether it is from photosynthesis or whether it's from other life reactions or whether it's purely chemical? And so we are working on biomarkers too, just like Chris's team, just a different one.
We're talking with Emil Ruff from the Marine Biological Laboratory and Chris German from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. With us, Chris German from HUI and Emil Ruff from MBL. Their labs were among the four selected by NASA's astrobiology program to help us better understand conditions under which we might find life beyond the planet.
So what are some of the challenges of working in these environments? You know, I'm thinking like deep sea, deep underground. And what have you learned over the course of your research that's helped you overcome some of those challenges?
Okay. For us, a lot of the things we've been thinking about is how do we automate what we do as oceanographers? You know, I've grown up in a culture where you walk up a gangplank and you take a bunch of equipment to sea on a big ship and then you do stuff. Right, with Alvin, you dive to the seafloor or you use a robot like Jason. None of that's feasible for space. So things have to be smaller and lighter, but they also have to be able to contend with new environments as well. So we've had to start thinking about both how do we put more intelligence in the brains of our robots? So that's been a technological thing. We've had to think about how do we operate under ice? And we've been having to learn about new environments that we hadn't, or certainly I hadn't thought about before, like what happens at the interface between the ice and the ocean at the top of an ocean in the Arctic. You know, we're used to the idea of a solid surface like the seafloor provides a great place for life to get established if you've got two different kinds of chemistry coming together where there's liquid and solid together. And most of the time in the ocean, the surface ocean isn't like that. The surface ocean is the place where all the sunlight is happening and there's waves and there's air getting mixed in. But at the poles on Earth, it gives us a chance to actually go and learn some new things about how do things interact across that ice-water interface and prepare, you know, expand our knowledge so we actually have a vocabulary to think about what could be happening on these other places.
Yeah. Emil?
Yeah, for us, similarly, one of the so for deep subsurface research, one of the main challenges is to obtain samples in the first place, because you can imagine it is very, very difficult and very costly to drill 2 kilometers deep in the seafloor. The ocean might already be 4 kilometers deep at that point, and then you have to drill another 2 kilometers deeper into the seafloor. Same is true for boreholes on land. And so a lot of times there are dedicated programs, scientific drilling programs, but a lot of times the research community really relies on commercial projects, like, for example, what I just mentioned, mines. So we have the permission to join an active gold mine and go down in the elevators and the trains with the miners to access these ecosystems. It would be way too costly to build a mine just for research. Mm-hmm. So getting the samples is difficult. And the other thing is one sample. Even though there are trillions and trillions of cells, of microbial cells on Earth, Earth is really inhabited by microbes. They're pervasive anywhere. You can go almost anywhere and you won't find a sterile place. However, in these deep ecosystems, there are very few of them per volume. So we're talking about in some of these fracture fluids in the rocks, we might have only 100 cells per milliliter. And that's about 1,000 or 10,000 times less than what you would have in tap water. So to get enough biomass, to get enough genetic material to really understand who these organisms are, what they're doing, what kinds of proteins they express, we usually need to either collect lots of sample, hundreds of liters of sample, or we really we work on the cutting edge of science using single cell methods to analyze single genomes, to analyze, visualize single cells under the microscope. So this is really sort of cutting-edge methodology that we have to sometimes develop our own because the samples we work are extremely difficult. And I wanted to say that earlier to your question, why Woods Hole? Woods Hole has been sort of a hub for astrobiology research for many decades. There's been many projects at MBL and at HUI that have been funded by NASA traditionally for decades now, because HUI and MBL are working on the kinds of ecosystems in the ocean and on Earth that really are model ecosystems for what we think could be habitats on other planets.
What NASA missions will be occurring during the 5-year grant period, and could data from those missions be used to help inform your research?
I was really lucky that at the end of 2024, I got invited to actually go and down to Cape Kennedy and see the launch of the Europa Clipper mission, which had been, I think, where I first started thinking about ocean world research was in 2015, when I'd seen a press release that they announced what instruments they were going to put on the Europa Clipper spacecraft so that it could make measurements when it got there. So it took off in 2024. Headed off in the wrong direction around Mars to get a gravity assist. So this holiday season at the end of 2026, it's going to be coming back past Earth, speeding up all the time. And so it's going to actually arrive in the Jupiter system in 2030. And in the meantime, the European Space Agency launched their mission called JUICE in 2023. And so that's already on its way as well. It's ahead of, but both of those two are going to arrive and be orbiting the different moons of Jupiter at the same time in the early 2030s. So our project is starting now. It's a 5-year project starting in 26. So we've got till the end of 2030 to make as many predictions as we can for that mission. But we also have, both in Europe and in the US, there's been strong recommendations, including from the National Academy, that the next thing people should do is actually go to Enceladus and plan to actually land somewhere to actually taste some of that fresh snow that's coming out from the South Pole and see what evidence we, see what we can find in that stuff that's come just directly from the ocean. So that's slightly longer ahead, but the nice thing is we're kind of like playing catch up scientifically to try and work out, okay, it was already decided in 2015 what measurements Europa Clipper would make in 2030. What have we learned about oceanography since that can allow us to be smarter about how we interpret the data that's going to come back? And then the second part of that is, what are we going to wish by 2030 we'd had on Europa Clipper? And how do we make sure that we actually start building that technology and make sure that the next time we go somewhere to Enceladus, that we have even better, more advanced technologies than we have today?
Yeah. Amelia, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that we, of course, would love to get our hands on any kind of measurements of nitrogen and oxygen compounds. That being done, also the isotopic composition of these compounds. Some of these instruments are on board, and so I'm waiting for to see what they're sniffing out there.
Yeah, it's so
But
exciting. Yeah. All right, Chris German, Senior Scientist in Geology and Geophysics at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Emil Ruff, Microbial Ecologist at the Ecosystem Center at Marine Biological Laboratory, both awarded research grants from NASA's Astrobiology Program. Boy, we are so excited to have you back as your research progresses. This is so exciting. Thanks so much for being here and filling
Well,
us in.
it's fun to be here at
Thank
the
you.
outset, and we'll have to come back and do this again as the research progresses.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me, Mindy.
Yes, thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by me, Amy Vince, with production assistance from Dan Tridle and Elsa Partan. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.